from 93.9 FM CICK, located in Smithers, British Columbia. Starting things off there with this new one from Panopticon, typically a black metal outfit, but has been making this really haunting country, and I'm here for it. All right, just a little setup for you. This is the second hour of Syrup Moves Radio, and we are going to play No Gods, No Masters, Part 3. It is a historical overview of anarchism. I have been playing this now over the last 3 weeks. This will be the third and final part, which means I've got to figure out what I'm going to do for the rest of the shows for the rest of my life, but that's okay. I hope you enjoy it. If you want to reach out to the show for any reason, syrupmoosrecords@gmail.com is where you can do that. If you want to submit your music to the show, send it there. I would ask, just one thing is maybe you could take a look at what the show is like before you submit the music. Maybe. I don't know. Other than that, yeah, I want to hear your music, so send it to me. As I said before, brand new album from Megafauna with Homesick Ghosts. It is an EP. It is called Nature is Healing, and it is terrifying, and I hope you enjoy it. Come and see me August 9th at Bulkley Valley Brewing, August 16th at CICK Deck Fest. What else? Go to themarsh.ca. That's where I keep all of my stuff. And buy my album, To the Land, oh my God, I Owe This Land a Body is available, and I will have it for sale at any show that you see me at. So I hope you pick it up, because I am very proud of it, and I think it is good, which is weird for me to say, but I do. All right, let's kick it off here, folks. This is the third part of No Gods, No Masters.
Whether individualist, illegalist, propagandist of the deed, anarcho-syndicalist, platformist, Christian anarchist, or anarcho-primitivist, anarchism has had as many nuances as it has faces. And now that it appears to be confined to a minority, people forget there was once a time that it dominated the world. And yet in the years following the First World War, in Europe, anarchism seemed to have lost all of its influence. It wasn't just the terrorist attacks by the so-called propagandists of the deed, or the widespread decreeing of spurious laws which forced anarchism into the shadows, but rather the bullets and shells of Verdun and the Somme, which killed in some countries up to a third of working men, leaving them in the war cemeteries along the Chemin des Dames and thus silencing the militants of the masses. Not to mention the millions of amputees, the brain damaged, and the seriously shell-shocked for whom revolution was no longer a priority. But outside of the industrialized nations of the West, anarchists survived on the edge of the great empires, taking up arms again and trying to deliver triumph to their ideals. And faced with reactionary tendencies, which also had numerous faces, libertarians could only imagine delightful utopias. During this fertile period between the wars, when capitalism gave birth to its two evil beasts, Stalinism and fascism, and faced with a totalitarian hydra which further generalized theft and industrialized death, they had to fight a war on two fronts and more than ever prove with their deeds the effectiveness of their thought. And thus the anarchists gave rise, not that we always remember, to some of the biggest revolutions of the 20th century, and wrote in red and black letters, a new page in our history. For 50 years, on the continent of America, anarchists formed the backbone of social action. They were members of the industrial workers of the world, which spread its wings from Canada to Australia. They fought alongside FORA, the huge Argentine Workers' Federation. In Bolivia, they gave FOI a red and black flag as its emblem. In Chile, they organized mass demonstrations, and among the ranks of FORU, in Uruguay, they led shows of strength on the streets of Montevideo. They controlled the docks in the Caribbean, opposed fledgling banana republics, and fought for the independence of Cuba and Puerto Rico. In the United States, they protested on roller skates against unemployment and against war, brandishing the skull and crossbones. It was the anarchists, and not the communists, who prompted within successive U.S. governments, despite the famous Red Scare, their darkest fears. In 1917, during yet another witch hunt, mass roundups were organized. Thousands of foreign anarchists were arrested as a prevention, held in prisons, and finally deported on the Buford, ever so subtly nicknamed the Soviet Ark. And as the land of liberty feared libertarians more than anything else, propaganda was spread against a backdrop of ragtime, smiles, and cartoons. Cartoons that amalgamated anarchist and Bolshevik vermin, assimilating them to rats that needed exterminating. Cartoons made by a joyous captain of industry who would end up showing his affection for the Nazi Party.
The United States is a country where the war against trade unions and other workers' movements was of an unparalleled brutality in the Western world, a brutality often enforced by the powers that be, aided by the mafia. Sounds unbelievable, but it's true. The government worked with the mafia to break the trade unions and the workers' movements.
There was a very strong repression in the United States, notably against Italian immigrant anarchists, who mainly adhered to the so-called anti-organizational tendencies. They were partisans who were in favor of expropriations, armed robberies, and so on. So the authorities took advantage of this situation to criminalize these activists. And Sacco and Vanzetti would pay the ultimate price.
Sacco and Vanzetti were two essentially rank-and-file anarchist militants who never would have been remembered by history except for what ends up happening to them. They are two followers of Luigi Galliani, the militant anarchist who promoted propaganda by the deed, who was also opposed to syndicalism, thought that unions were dangerous because they tended to be hierarchical, tended to be bureaucratic, and that he worried they would become barriers between workers and their goals. So he opposed unions as the vehicle to create revolution. instead look to create large-scale insurrections, hopefully inspired by some of these acts.
Dozens of attacks were carried out targeting those who represented power, such as the billionaire Rockefeller and Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, seen here viewing the aftermath of a bombing from his window. The authorities' eyes naturally turned to the movement led by Luigi Galliani, partisan of the propaganda of the deed. In his newspaper, Cronaca Subversiva, this lawyer advocated the direct, immediate, and individual use of violence. His booklet, La Salute en Voi, Salvation is in You, enjoyed a degree of success. In its foreword, what was basically a bomb-making manual was presented as a must-have for any proletarian family. For several years, his influence had grown within the Italian community.
Sacco and Vanzetti belonged to that current in the anarchist movement. They were militants. They believed in, you know, revolution by any means necessary, the sooner the better. At the time that they're arrested, they don't know that that's why they're being arrested. They think they're being arrested because they're anarchists and because anarchists are being rounded up. So they are very evasive when they're interrogated. They don't answer everything truthfully, which ends up being brought up at their trial and used as evidence against them.
On the steps of the Boston courthouse, thronging with reporters and onlookers, the shoemaker and fishmonger were accused of being the authors of an armed robbery which resulted in the death of two people late in 1919. Although neither of them had a police record, their anarchic tendencies were enough to see them charged. As the flashbulbs popped, this minor incident became a political affair.
It becomes a very, very high-profile case. There's a large, an extremely large movement in support of Sacco and Vanzetti that grows not just in the United States, but worldwide. There's a Save Sacco and Vanzetti movement because an increasing number of people, not just anarchists and radicals, but liberals of various stripes, unions, become convinced that the evidence against them is extremely flimsy, which it is.
On American soil, anarchists tried everything to have the two prisoners released. Firstly, with bombs, like the attack on Wall Street, the first car bomb in history, which resulted in 38 deaths and 200 injuries, but to no avail. Then through a legal battle, with appeals, cross-examinations, new trials, which, despite their death sentence, managed to delay their execution for 7 years. And finally, through a media campaign, with defense committees springing up pretty much everywhere. But although the campaigns to defend Sacco and Vanzetti were initiated by anarchists, as strange as it might seem, it was those across the globe, those who had become their worst enemies, who took up their defense.
It's, of course, ironic because the communists adopted their cause. But the communists, of course, at the same time were executing and imprisoning anarchists in the Soviet Union. So they certainly didn't have any real sympathy for Sacco and Vanzetti's political beliefs.
On sait aujourd'hui qu'effectivement c'est à Moscou que la décision a été prise.
Today we know that Moscow took the decision to champion Sacco and Vanzetti, to turn them into the symbol of bourgeois repression, capital repression, in the country that epitomized capitalism, the United States of America.
It also earned them moral capital, good feeling in the socialist and working class movements for them to champion these two Italian Americans who are facing death. And so they did manipulate the Sacco and Vanzetti case and use their martyrdom in order to further their own political interests. And that's very sad.
Unaware of the attempts at manipulation, but aware of the injustices carried out on anarchists, grassroots communist activists stepped up their efforts. On the Place de la République in Paris, France, in Tokyo, Berlin, Sofia, Asunción, and Trafalgar Square in London, England, communists also protested against the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, but in vain.
Nevertheless, despite this widespread public outrage, they are both executed. They're sent to the electric chair in 1927 after their sentences are upheld. And this is, it's a devastating blow.
The anarchist movement was crushed in the United States. And you weren't really to see much in the way of an anarchist movement in the United States again until the 1960s.
It would be many years for all the manipulation and exploitation to be denounced and admitted, resulting in the governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis, finally proclaiming that any disgrace should be forever removed from their names. And 50 years to the day after their execution, thanks to Joan Baez singing to music composed by Ennio Morricone, Vanzetti's last words, the Death March of the Anarchists finally became an international hymn for justice and freedom.
Anarchism then suffered by becoming a huge diaspora, a diaspora of Russian anarchists, North American anarchists, Italian anarchists. Naturally, many of them moved to France, because France wasn't a dictatorship. It was still a free democracy. So they emigrated to France.
The anarchist movement, which had hoped for a triumphant revolution in the aftermath of the First World War, found itself beaten on all fronts. And the question arose, why were we beaten?
In the roaring 20s, Paris became the center of the world once more. Montparnasse took over the artistic baton from Montmartre. In the tinted light of the first neons at the Brasserie La Rotonde, Le Dôme, et Le Select, following in the footsteps of Courbet, Pissarro, and Seurat, artists were inspired by libertarian thought. Artists like Marcel Duchamp, self-proclaimed ant-artist, certain members of the Dada movement who published their early works in libertarian magazines, the first surrealist who adhered to poet André Breton's statement that an anarchist world or a surrealist world is the same thing, the Russian émigré painter seeking refuge in Paris, British and American authors, and those who remain unclassifiable, like Léo Mallet, Jean Dubuffet, Jean Vigo, and Jean Cocteau. Anarchism swept through the arts with its wind of freedom and rebellion. But far from the velvet-covered cafe benches, soon after the armistice, the workers' movement, with its 1.5 million dead and 4 million war wounded, paid dearly for the folly of a few men, and in the patriotic headlines that followed victory, workers gradually turned their backs on anarchism.
There was a real break, a cultural break, which resulted from society having been totally militarized for 4 years. That did not favor the growth of anarchism, and I don't think it was down to chance that the form the Workers' Party took after World War I was Bolshevism. Bolshevism had a hierarchical structure very similar to that of the factory and the army.
In the 1920s, despite the massive strikes led by revolutionary socialists, French society and the workers' movement began yielding, slowly but surely, to new tendencies. By founding the French Communist Party after the Tours Congress, Marxist-Leninists, strengthened by the seizing of power by the Bolshevik Party in Russia and the creation of the Comintern, began to attract the proletariat. The communists gained ground on the anarchists, took over their structures, and appropriated their martyrs and symbols, like the Internationale, which, after the removal of a few bothersome lines, became the Soviet hymn. The struggle led by Leninists across the globe also claimed its victims. Two anarchists were killed in violent street fights over the control of the trade union headquarters. But as if that weren't enough, in the post-war years, anarchists saw a new threat rise up. For to mislead workers even more, to fascinate the working class, and to reassure the lower middle class, capitalism decided to wear its most spectacular mask yet. Fascism.
The fascists had fought in the war and had learned the most evil lesson of war, which is violence. But unlike the violence of the revolutionary left, fascist violence was more professional. The fascists had learned during the war that violence needed to be extremely well organized.
The expansion of the fascist movement through violence was accompanied by an attempt to appropriate the symbols of anarchism. Such was the case of Action Française, presided over by Charles Maurras. It created the Proudhon Circle, a political think tank named after the founder of anarchism, so as to attract workers into its fold. It would become the cradle of French fascism. Or like Benito Mussolini, a former teacher and journalist who founded the Italian National Fascist Party and dressed his young militiamen in the black shirts of the anarchist movement. This son of a socialist revolutionary had even frequented leading figures of the anarchist movement, such as Lido Raffanelli, the Italian activist who converted to Islam, with whom he had a brief relationship as a young man. And it was probably this which gave rise to the legend that Il Duce himself had been an anarchist before World War I.
There's a wonderful anecdote which gives us an idea of Malatesta's intuition. In 1913, Malatesta returned to Italy and visited Milan, where he met with Mussolini for an hour. At the end, they said goodbye, and a friend of Malatesta asked him, "So what do you make of Mussolini?" Malatesta replied, "He's not a socialist, and even less an anarchist. He's a revolutionary who will clear lots of paths." Indeed, it's true that Mussolini had translated Kropotkin's The Great French Revolution into Italian, but he had never been an anarchist. Never.
And after Malatesta, anarchists were convinced that they would need to fight against the new European despots with violence, and they alone would fight against the threat with weapons. Like in Italy, when Michele Schiro, Angelo Spadolotto, and Anteo Zamboni, who would end up being lynched by a mob, plotted their own assassination attempts against Mussolini. In Spain, fascist dictator Primo de Rivera was the target, while in France, the heroic Germaine Burton shot down the chief editor of Action Française's newspaper. And in the United States, which had installed a genuinely apartheid regime, only the libertarians of the IWW dared stand up to the racist militia of the Ku Klux Klan. And let's not forget that in Germany, the anarchist Marinus Vandelube set fire to the Reichstag because it had become the antechamber of Hitlerism. But for the majority in the movement, individual response was no longer adapted, and it was during the debates held by the first anti-fascist fronts that they advocated what was for them the only possible response to the threat.
Among the anti-fascist fronts, it became a question of a lesser evil. If the principal evil was fascism, they would need to unite to fight fascism, and once fascism had been defeated, they would fight amongst each other, but dialectically, about the different ways to organize society.
Questa proposta degli anarchici non è accettata.
The anarchists didn't accept that. They believed they should fight fascism militarily and also fight with a social revolution. To them, the only way to eradicate fascism was through revolution, which would drain the financial and social foundations of fascism.
In June 1926, in Paris, a pamphlet was published entitled Organizational Platform of the General Union of Anarchists. It was a thunderclap in the small libertarian world, not only for the appeal it launched to unite the movement, which had always rebelled against all forms of organization, but also for the name of its principal signatory, a returnee from the ashes and tears of the Ukraine, then working on the assembly line at Renault, and whose body was one big scar, Nestor Makhno.
Makhno arrived in Paris having experienced prison camps in Romania, Poland, and so on. And he arrived at a time when revolutionary ideals were in decline because they were no longer the dish of the day across Europe. Plus, the image of the Soviet Union was positive enough for the communist movement to build itself upon. So the anarchist movement found itself extremely marginalized.
A number of anarchists believe that the origin of their defeat lay in the absence of organization and the lack of togetherness between anarchist groups. And this point of view was upheld by the so-called Makhnovists, the supporters of Makhno, who would publish, with Arshinov, documents in which they declared themselves favorable to the founding of an organized anarchist body, based on the principle of collective responsibility, which they believe to be fundamental to taking up the fight again and eventually winning it.
Anarchism is no beautiful fantasy, no abstract notion of philosophy, but a social movement of the working masses. For that reason alone, it must gather its forces into one organization, as demanded by the reality and strategy of the social class struggle. The organizational platform published below represents the outline, the skeleton of such a program, and must serve as the first step towards gathering anarchist forces into a single, active, revolutionary anarchist collective capable of struggle. It's high time that anarchism emerged from the swamp of disorganization. Long live the organized anarchist movement. Long live the general anarchist union. Long live the social revolution of the world's workers.
Some may have interpreted the platform as a desire to copy the Bolshevik Party, but it was actually the transposition of what the Makhnovists stood for as an anarchist group, by which I mean the elimination of anarchism from artistic trends, from individualistic tendencies, and from terrorist anarchism. It was clearly a class war led by armed groups.
Rather than encourage the union of the anarchist movement, Makhno's appeal caused one of those endless debates that only libertarians were capable of. Responses flew in from across the globe. Oppositions, controversies, syntheses, total confusion reigned. And all this simply convinced Makhno and his followers even further that the anarchist movement needed discipline and unity. He decided to gather his supporters at Les Les Roses in the Paris suburbs for an international congress held on the 20th of March, 1927, at the movie theater Les Roses. Among those who attended were anarchists from Russia, Italy, Poland, Bulgaria, and even China, including the author Bajim. But at the time, Makhno was more focused on the situation in Spain.
Why Spain? People have often asked the question. Maybe because people don't like anarchists. It was Leo Ferré who said that. But more realistically, it's because in Spain, socialists were already viewed as anarchists. It wasn't a socialist tendency. In Spain, socialism was already seen as anarchistic.
Anarchism in Spain didn't just have working-class roots, like in France or Italy. It had a genuine working-class foundation made up of hundreds of thousands of activists.
A working-class foundation which gave rise to a young 30-year-old anarchist mechanic who had sought refuge in Paris and had caught the eye of Makhno. His name? Buenaventura Durruti. They swapped stories, talked of past failures, and spoke of new possibilities. Durruti revealed his terrorist past, explained the already old organization of the Spanish anarchist movement, and told of his hopes for a revolution in Catalonia or in the plains of Aragon, which so resembled the steppes of the Ukraine. Impressed by the bravery, intelligence, and determination of the Spaniard, Makhno gave him a copy of his political manifesto and vowed that if a revolution were to be sparked in Spain, he would come to fight at his side.
What the anarchists represented and aspired to was a very lofty ideal that would take a lot of preparation. In Spain, they had been preparing for 70 to 80 years for the Spanish Civil War. So when revolution hit Spain, people were ready, because they had been preparing a long time for it.
In 1936, in Spain, the anarchists weren't only prepared because since the late 19th century, they had carried out a number of propagandist of the deed missions, like the attacks by the mysterious Mano Negra, Black Hand, or the 1912 assassination of the Prime Minister by Manuel Parrilla Serrano, reconstructed here for a docudrama. Neither was it because some of the major martyrs of the cause, like the suspected anarchists garroted in Jerez de la Frontera, Francisco Ferrer, and the peasants murdered in the Casas Viejas, were Spanish. Nor was it because the Catalan anarchist newspaper rang out the same slogan ad for the Mexican Revolution. And nor was it because some of the major peasant and factory worker uprisings had taken place in the Levante, in Andalusia, in the Rioja, in Catalonia, and finally in Asturias with the October Revolution, quashed by the young General Franco under orders from the recently elected center-right government. No, Spanish anarchists were ready because the libertarian movement had been solidly organized from its earliest days. Firstly, within a powerful Spanish section of the Workers' International Industrial Union,
Then within the FAI, the Iberian Anarchist Federation, and the CNT, the National Confederation of Labor, which, on the eve of Franco's coup d'etat, was one of the best structured unions